Today we'll be discussing Dave Chappelle, and we'll be discussing the medical complications of cannabis use. This is Doctor versus Comedian. I'm Dr. Asif Doja, and this is the Doctor of Laughs.
Not a real doctor.
Ali Hassan. Every episode, I pick a topic for Ali from comedy and entertainment, and then I question him about it. Then Ali picks a topic from medicine and health and grills me on that topic. Today, we'll be discussing Dave Chappelle, including our thoughts on his new stand-up special, The Dreamer. Then, in our second half, we'll be talking about the medical complications of cannabis. Now, Ali, how are these two linked?
Allegedly, Dave Chappelle smokes a boatload of weed.
Yeah, I believe that is pretty true. I believe he admits to that as well. So a few housekeeping notes, Ali, before we get started. First of all, we've just been back from a little hiatus. Thanks to everyone who's been checking out our classic episodes we've been airing over the past few weeks. Also got some listener mail that we're a bit behind on, so I want to get to just one of those. This is from a listener named Julie, and she was writing to us because of our episode about polycystic ovarian syndrome. We did that with the David Beckham episode in December. And she mentioned two things that she wanted us to kind of be clear about, which I think is a good point. She said, first of all, we mentioned that weight loss is important if you have obesity with PCOS, but it's also important that people who have PCOS can sometimes have a very hard time losing the weight, and sometimes they need hormonal therapy or medications like metformin. So sometimes it's easier said than done. So good point. And the second point that she wanted to bring up is that ovarian cysts can sometimes burst, and they can be very painful. They can almost mimic appendicitis. So that's another good point. So we thank Julie for bringing up those two points. And now, Ali, on to the Dreamer, a.k.a. Dave Chappelle. So, Ali, I want to talk to you about Dave Chappelle. You know,
that's really a pretty big sigh to start off.
I know. It's hard to know where to start off with him. I mean, he is definitely one of the comedians of this generation, if not the comedian of this generation. But, of course, we're going to get into some more controversial things he said. So let's start off with a bit of his background, and we can kind of go from there. So his family is actually quite famous. His father was a professor of vocal performance and the dean of students at Antioch College in Ohio. His mother worked for the Congolese prime minister, and she was a minister, like a evangelical minister, and she worked at various institutions. And his family history is very interesting. He has a lot of early physicians in his family. You know, obviously it was more difficult to be black and be a physician in America. So he has surgeons in his family history. His great-grandfather was born into slavery and then, of course, you know, was emancipated and then served as president of Allen University. So his other great-grandfather, Robert Palmer, was a member of the South Carolina legislature, which was then majority black and was involved in that during Reconstruction. And like I said, lots of physicians in his family as well. So it comes from quite a pedigreed family. And then I guess he went to an arts high school and studied theater arts, graduated in 1991, and then decided to kind of pursue stand-up comedy, right, Ali?
Yeah, I don't think he was old enough to get into, I don't know why I'm saying think. I know for a fact he was not even old enough to be in a lot of these places. So his mother had to come with him. That's how this story goes. And he's always grateful to his mother for, you know, doing something that, imagine your kids ask you to do that. It's like, it's one thing to be like taking your kids to soccer and they join a team and there's other parents there. This is a very solitary exercise. He is the only kid, and you are the only parent of a kid who's on stage, you know, in this kind of scenario. So full respect to Mrs. Chappelle, Ms. Chappelle. I'm not sure. I don't know what her, I got to look up her name, but she was a big help in, obviously, you know, if she saw the same sort of prodigy that many of us fans see, you know, I guess it was probably a little easier to take her, you know, it's not the same thing as me taking my son to hockey and he sucks at hockey and we have to still sit there for 2 hours and watch that.
Well, you know, I guess he went to the Apollo Theater in Harlem.
Yeah, he actually talks about this moment inside the actor's studio with James Lipton, and it's pretty great. Also clearly a fan of Dave Chappelle's. And he's talking about, you know, 18 or 19 years old, and he goes to the Apollo. Now, the Apollo, if you don't know, the Apollo was this very storied establishment. It's in Harlem for many years in the 20s, 30s, black people not allowed into the Apollo, even though it was the crown jewel of, there was a couple of them, but what is like this crown jewel of vaudeville, and black people were not allowed to attend there. Yeah. And then they were allowed to perform, but not attend. And then they were allowed to attend and closed down for many years. When it came back into being, the Apollo Theater was definitely this sort of cultural mecca in around Harlem. And it dates to the time of the Harlem Renaissance. A very, very story. I encourage people to look up the Apollo. If you see just like Night at the Apollo, it's one thing. But to know what it means to some of these, particularly black performers who would know that history, it's fantastic. So this young guy, I assume coming from the pedigree that you just mentioned, Asif, would have gotten a little bit of schooling on like, oh, you're going to the Apollo. This is what it means. Goes on to get booed. Mercilessly booed. And when he talks to James Lipton, he's just very, very funny. He's like, I saw like old people booing me. I saw everybody was just booing me. I was like, what kind of person boos a child? You know, what kind of person enthusiastically breaks down a child's dream and gets this joy out of it? And then there's this character, Sandman, who's like this throwback character. He comes on and pulls you by the neck with a cane or sweeps up around you. So the Sandman came out and he goes, I hate that dude. I hate Sandman. But in the end, this is a testament to Dave Chappelle's success. He said, you know, obviously that was the worst night. But then he said, then I thought about it. I was like, hey, I'm still here. I'm still alive. That was the worst night imaginable. And it really wasn't that bad. And he said, I became fearless because of that night at the Apollo. But yeah, it's interesting to hear his story around that. And also interesting to get a little insight into who Dave Chappelle is. Now, is he still that same guy? I'm not sure, but certainly that fed his work ethic and his drive back then.
He then eventually found success with black audiences by appearing on Russell Simmons' Def Comedy Jam. I think all of us know Def Comedy Jam on HBO. And then, of course, that really pushed him forward. Then he was doing all the late night shows and really was becoming this superstar in the comedy world. A couple of interesting trivia points at this stage of his career. At age 19, he opened for Aretha Franklin, which is amazing that he was able to do that. 19. The other thing I didn't know, did you know, Ali, he was originally offered the role of Bubba in Forrest Gump, like of Bubba Gump Shrimp, and he thought the character was demeaning and the movie would bomb, so he turned down the part. I think half of that assumption is true. It was demeaning, but the movie did not bomb, and everybody loves Bubba Gump, right?
No, that is news to me. I think he's a pretty gifted actor, Dave Chappelle, and I think he could have pulled it off. But I kind of like the way it all worked out in the end. But that's crazy.
Totally. He then moves on to co-writing the stoner film Half-Baked with Neil Brennan. We'll talk about Neil Brennan in a second. Have you seen Half-Baked?
I have, but that's like late 90s. You're not going to mention Robin Hood Men in Tights, huh? Where he played Achoo?
I never saw that, but I know that his character supposed to be like the equivalent of the Morgan Freeman character in the Robin Hood Prince of Thieves?
I don't know because I don't remember what Morgan Freeman did.
I love it. You remember Men in Tights more than, okay, well, that's very good. Okay.
Also, wait, there's another character. Do you know who Reggie Warrington is?
Yes.
Does that mean anything
to you? He's in a movie, a serious movie.
No. No,
a comedy movie.
No. Yes.
Which one is this?
Reggie Warrington was this obnoxious stand-up comic on stage in the first Nutty Professor.
Ooh,
the only Nutty Professor that I'm
that
proud
was that was watch. Chappelle.
Oh yeah, man, gosh. He's super obnoxious, he's like, he does a really good job playing an obnoxious jerk of a comedian.
Yeah, I totally remember
that. That was one of those ones where I realized later that it was Chappelle, similar to 40-Year-Old Virgin. I realized later that was Kevin Hart. who comes in and has that argument, you know, and he's like, all y'all going to get clapped up.
I didn't know that was Kevin Hart either. So this is all very interesting. Oh my God. Of course, you know, because Chappelle's done some dramatic roles. He was in A Star Is Born. He has this kind of role with that in Bradley Cooper's movie. So I'm getting a bit confused with his comedic roles and his serious roles. But of course, in 2000, he does his first hour-long HBO special, which is Dave Chappelle's Killing Them Softly. And Ali, you talked about this special on our podcast before.
Yeah. Yeah, his first two specials, both of them are fantastic. I really like Killing Them Softly. 4 years later, he did a Showtime special For What It's Worth. That was recorded in San Francisco. I love those two specials. Those were like, you know, once I saw those, I was like, oh, I'll go wherever this guy needs me to go. I'll watch whatever special he puts out. Guess what? He doesn't put out another special for 14 years. So
right. Well, we'll get to that. And now he has one basically every year for the past couple of years. So then in 2003, he began Chappelle's Show, which is one of the most classic sketch comedy shows of all time. And let's start with Chappelle's Show. What did you think about when it first came out? What are your thoughts of the show in general? We'll get into some of the issues.
You know, I have it on DVD. I still sometimes walk by it and think, has that stood up to the test of time? I'd like to watch it. However, here's the thing, man. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was the greatest satire. I thought it was a mockery of the right things in the sense that it was mocking how, like, imagine a world like this, but you're making fun of, like, white people in a way. You're making fun of the system. You're making fun of racism and how absurd it is by showing something equally absurd. I thought it was, you know, this advanced level of satire. Very surprised to have found out in later years. Anyone who knows Chappelle is aware that he was overworked. He was sick of working there 20 hours a week. 20 hours a day, I should say, and he sort of burnt out. That's the easiest explanation. But he also talked about this idea of doing the wrong jokes. You know, the way he didn't think Bubba Gump was a good representation of a black man, a black person. I think he got to the feeling, and I don't have any exact quotes here, but he got to feeling like, I am doing stuff that is the wrong stuff is being laughed at, possibly by the wrong people as well.
Yeah, totally. I read that as well. And there's a good article with Neil Brennan. So Neil Brennan was his co-writer, co-creator of Chappelle's Show. And it was a white guy. I think he thought, he being a Chappelle, when talking to Neil Brennan, that like some of the sketches were actually socially irresponsible and reinforced ideas of like minstrelism. And here, Chappelle.
Minstrelsy. Let's keep it
minstrelsy.
Sorry.
Yes. I mean, you know, still racist. Chappelle remembers a time where a white crew member laughed during filming of a sketch. And he said it was uncomfortable because he said, I felt that they were laughing at me and not with me. And I think this kind of permeated his thinking over time. You know, the Rick James sketch, right? People would yell, I'm Rick James, bitch, in the middle of his stand-up shows. And he basically said, like, in the stand-up show, he's like, this show is ruining my life. Like, he can't do what he wants because people are just saying that. I mean, of course, he was offered the part of Rick James in a Rick James biopic, but Rick James's family put a halt to the film. They didn't want to, which is fine because that's how a lot of people remember Rick James now, is from that sketch.
Yeah.
But so he basically had this issue. And then in season three, or before season three started, I guess, he just left. And he's like, he didn't do it. And he left, and he kind of left to South Africa. So it wasn't clear exactly, as you're saying, the reasons why. Was it burnout? Was it a mental illness issue? Who knows? Could have been a lot of things. He said he just needed to get away. And he wanted to get away from the distractions of fame, you know, get rid of his ego, just become more of a well-rounded person, want to be balanced, you know? So that's why he left. He left a $50 million contract with Comedy Central. And again, like we said, this formed a rift with Neil Brennan, who was his co-writer, co-creator. And I don't know. I mean, you, I think, know a bit more now. You and some of our buddies have watched some of Neil Brennan's comedy. I don't know what you think, Ali, in terms of how Neil Brennan's been doing.
Yeah, I met Neil Brennan. I was on a comedy panel with him. But more importantly, I think he was a guy who was losing out on a lot of money and in no control of getting it back, right? He was probably a guy who's like, hey, we have a good thing here. Come on, Dave, what do you mean you're in South Africa? Come back. Like, I'm sure he was like in a bit of a panic. I'm sure that was incredibly anxiety inducing for Neil Brennan. He didn't have any say. He's not the talent. And so he has no control over this money that God knows, you know, if he'd already spent half of it in his mind and was expecting this money and depending on it, and now it's just gone and it's not coming. And 50 million didn't mean that much to Dave Chappelle at that time. I'm sure it meant a hell of a lot to Neil Brennan. So yeah, I'm sure it was a desperate time for Neil.
Two other bits of trivia.
Which would contribute to a rift.
Yeah, for sure. Two other bits of trivia before we get into talking about Chappelle's latest special. He said, him being Chappelle, said that one of his biggest influences was Bugs Bunny, which is very interesting, right? And you can actually see it now when you look at him, kind of this troublemaker. And he thought Mel Blanc was like the best. Obviously, Mel Blanc was the voice of Bugs Bunny. And he said that was a really huge influence on him. I don't know. Can you see that in Chappelle a bit?
I mean, Bugs Bunny, very confident, very confident. You replace that carrot with a cigarette. Maybe, that's Dave Chappelle.
And likes to disturb the ish, you know. I think that is something Chappelle, well, we'll get to it. I think that's what he does now, basically. And then also, I didn't know this, he converted to Islam, Dave Chappelle, not Bugs Bunny, but Dave Chappelle converted to Islam when he was 17. And he just does.
Mel Blanc was Muslim? Yeah, that I'm surprised you don't know that. That's a well-known fact about Dave Chappelle. He doesn't talk about it much because he doesn't feel qualified to speak about it. He doesn't, you know, think that that's his place, but I mean, he's 50 now, I think. So he has been a Muslim for quite some time. I think I get the feeling, this is just, you know, personal hunch. I get the feeling it's something that's very personal to him and he doesn't need anybody else weighing in on
it. Well, exactly. I read a quote from him,
which is what religion should
from be. Time Magazine, where he said, I don't talk about my religion publicly because I don't want people to associate me and my flaws with this beautiful thing. Oh, so it's very interesting, right? Yeah. A lot of people say, you might say the opposite. Oh, Islam, you know, it's a backwards religion and I don't want to be associated with that. But obviously it's the opposite. He doesn't want his flaws being put on this religion. Very interesting.
Yeah.
Statement. So, okay. So, as we mentioned, Dave Chappelle signed a huge deal with Netflix several years ago for his comedy specials. And the most recent one, which came out about a month or two ago, is The Dreamer. And this special coming out generated some controversy. So I thought, let's talk a bit about the controversy and then we can talk about the special itself. So the controversy in Dave Chappelle is he has a lot of jokes that are making fun of trans people. And I guess, and he has come under attack from the trans community. And so I would say it's been this past three specials at least where he has trans jokes. And I'll just tell you my opinion about this. Dave Chappelle has been pretty clear, especially in his second last special, about why he makes these jokes, because he doesn't think anything should be off limits, and he doesn't think trans people deserve special treatment compared to every other group that he makes fun of. That is my interpretation of it. My issue with Dave Chappelle and the trans jokes is I don't actually think they're funny jokes, and I'm still waiting for him to tell a funny joke. He tells a very touching story about his friend who was trans in a couple specials ago, but I don't know. So I'm curious as what you think about this controversy, Ali.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't help but think of Ricky Gervais when I watched this. It's the same sort of thing. It's like, is it just an axe to grind? And is it just like, no, I'll do these jokes because they said I should. Right. And that's why I'm going to do these jokes.
I think he thinks, sorry to interrupt you. Yeah. I think him and Gervais think they're the only people who can do this because they're so famous. They have so much money that they can make these jokes, but everybody else is afraid to make the jokes. I don't know.
Maybe. I mean, that's, you're painting a picture of the two of these guys putting themselves on quite a pedestal. Many people would probably agree with you. Dave Chappelle in this special does talk about how good he is. I mean, and he is, you know, but it's like both Ricky and Dave don't seem to, like, on stage anyway, humility is not their thing. And I think for Ricky Gervais, it's sort of like the quote unquote woke society at large. For Dave, it's trans. And I like to watch a special where I'm not thinking about somebody's personal vendetta. The exception to that was Chris Rock. You watched it, the latest Chris Rock, you watched it, anticipating right. there is a Will Smith right. line
totally,
coming up.
Totally.
That didn't bother me. You know, for the first 15 minutes, I'm like, when's he going to do it? And then I realized, of course, it's going to be the end. Of course, it's going to be the end. Why would he do it at the beginning? That's ridiculous. And then I calmed down and I enjoyed the special for what it was. But the same way that I don't want to watch a television show and be thinking about an actor's politics or like, forget that. I don't even want to be thinking about, oh, that's interesting. Where did the director choose? What light mm-hmm. were they using? Is that artificial mm-hmm. light? Is that camera? I want the acting to be, you know, and the storyline and the rest of it to be good enough that it makes me forget about all these other things that my mind might drift to. And the same thing goes for comedy. As soon as I'm thinking about this person and their own axe to grind and their own issues and their motivation for telling these jokes, it's taking me out of the comedy. And that then makes the comedy less comedic. And then I turn into a guy who has the same opinion as you. And I hate that, obviously, as if no. Then I share your opinion, which is that either you got to be funnier so that I don't think about this. Really, my perspective is move on.
Right. Because I must admit, I watched it and I tried to predict when he was going to make a trans joke. And it's almost like now he's become the trans joke comedian, which, I mean, is that what you want? Why would you want to just be known for making fun of one group of people? It just doesn't make any sense. And I think Chappelle's kind of played himself a bit in this, in my opinion. But what did you think of the overall special as a whole? Like I said, there are a few trans jokes. He does make fun of a lot of other groups.
Well, it feels like it's the first 10 minutes of the special, not just a few. It feels like he's making other jokes and still brings the trans
exactly,
thing
exactly.
in. You know?
But he does make fun of, you know, Asian people. His wife is Asian. He makes fun of, certainly makes fun of disabled people. That happens in the very beginning of the show. Whether you find those jokes funny or not, that's, you know, probably your mileage may vary, I guess. But what did you think overall?
I thought, in the end, it's like, you know, I have my own, as I've mentioned, I have my own sort of gold standards, which is his first two albums. And, you know, on this podcast, I'm saying stuff like this way too much, and it really dates me. I said this about U2 as well. You know, it's always like early U2 and early Nirvana and early Pearl Jam. And so I'm trying not to be that guy. But at the end of the day, I was like, would I recommend this special to somebody? That's the way I'm trying to look at this. And I think I would, with some caveats. And I think I felt the same way about Ricky Gervais. Like, look, there's some great parts. There's some shades of brilliance. When you're a brilliant person, you're going to show off some of your brilliance. Are you willing to wade through some of the other stuff, which isn't as strong, to get to that brilliance? That's on you. So that's where the caveat comes in. Do recommend with some, you know, with a little bit of a forewarning, little preamble from myself.
I totally agree. It almost disappoints me in a sense because, like I said, some of these trans jokes, disabled jokes, I mean, the Asian joke, his wife's Asian, so I'm not really sure I can comment about that. And there's some, as you said, flashes of brilliance. The best section of this is when he talks about Chris Rock and Chris Rock being slapped by Will Smith. He has a whole section about that, which is very well done. And then he talks about this episode, which we didn't mention yet, was when he was performing at the Hollywood Bowl in 2022, and he was attacked by somebody on stage. This was a homeless person who attacked him, and it turns out the person had a gun, but it wasn't a gun. It was actually a knife disguised as a gun, which is very unusual. But, you know, and goes through everything that happened and the fallout of that. That's really well done. That's the highlight.
It's well done, and it was also made me feel for Chris Rock a little bit, like, right? Like, he goes, I got the opportunity to watch my celebrity friends beat the crap out of somebody, right? He says something to that effect. Yep. Chris Rock, just how alone must that dude have felt? Will Smith goes back to his seat. He's got to go back to camera. He's just like, okay, let's continue the show. Whereas Will Smith is like, it's live, it's not filmed. So it's like, okay, you stepped up to the wrong dude and now some people are going to make you pay the price. So yeah, I can see the joy in that for a performer to have somebody, you know, sort of take care of that person. I mean, I wouldn't want him to be like permanently injured or anything. And I obviously didn't know the background about this guy at the time. But yeah, again, felt really pretty awful for Chris Rock. And anyway, I don't want to give away the line if somebody hasn't watched this Chappelle special yet. But yeah, no, it's well done. It's great. All right, Oscars. Now, speaking of people who, you know, work hard at certain things, the same aforementioned Dave Chappelle works pretty hard at enjoying marijuana. There's no secret about that. I think that's a big part of his life. I've a close friend of mine who's also a comedian in Toronto, used to work at an event space, and Dave was there after his show here in Toronto, and it was just a ton of weed, That's his big thing. That's his comfort space. So it's obvious that we would talk about that today. There's no stretch there whatsoever. But I think I wanted to talk to you about a few things with respect to marijuana, because number one, I have a friend. She's very public. I can mention her name. Her name is Allison Dore. Allison is a friend of mine. She's very public about this. She hosts a show on Sirius XM in Canada, Sirius XM Canada. She has her own show. It's a talk show. She talks very publicly about having been addicted to marijuana and always butts head with people who are adamant about the fact that you cannot be addicted. And she says, no, I was psychologically addicted to marijuana. So I definitely wanted to talk to you about that. And also, I know some people who started smoking early in their early teens, and a few of them aren't right in the head, man. I don't know how else to say it. Yeah. They're not right. And then I don't have any proof that that is connected to marijuana and other drug use at a young age, but I certainly, my mind goes there, and I wanted to talk about that. So why don't we start by talking about this idea about cannabis and addiction?
This is, really good questions, Ali. So we could talk first about the short-term use. So we can picture if someone is intoxicated with, you know, cannabis, then you're going to have problems with short-term memory, with motor coordination, and maybe altered judgment because you're high. And of course, this is an issue, I think, with driving. I think when marijuana was legalized in Canada, and of course it's been legalized in several states in the US, I don't think people paid enough attention to the fact that people are going to be getting high and driving, and the implications of that on motor vehicle accidents.
Sure. I also think a lot of people didn't understand what legalized meant, right? I think people were like, okay, marijuana is allowed
now. Exactly.
Everywhere. Exactly. I'll go high to class. It's not against the law.
Exactly.
I can do that. I can do that. But forgetting that.
Because you're not going to drink, in the middle of your job or whatever. And so I think, and then, you overhear people talking about, having their gummies and things like that. And I don't know if they're thinking about driving the same way they think about drinking and driving. So that's my own editorializing there.
All right, some anecdotes. I like it. It's about time.
And it's also very difficult to test people for acute intoxication of marijuana because marijuana will stay in your body for a long period of time. So you can just say, no, I smoked this a couple of days ago. And that's why you're picking this up, right? So it becomes a bit difficult to prove that someone's actually acutely intoxicated. So getting back to what you were talking about addiction, about 9% of users overall become addicted to marijuana. So you can definitely become addicted to it. If you are a daily user, 25 to 50% of those people would be considered to be psychologically addicted to marijuana. And as you said, it's a psychological addiction. In our previous episode, a few months ago, we talked about addiction, and you can have a physical addiction to things like alcohol, opioids, etc. This is a psychological addiction. You need this to help with your anxiety, depression, coping skills, daily enjoyment of life, whatever. We've also found that there is actually a bona fide cannabis withdrawal syndrome. This is more recent information where we found that people who stop using cannabis abruptly will have irritability, sleeping difficulties, low mood, and then cravings, anxiety. So there is maybe this effect that you can see when people withdraw from it. The other question you asked is about, the longer term effects, maybe in terms of your brain. Right. And of course, we know that brain development overall continues in most people normally until your early 20s. Right. We don't think about that. But even when you're, say, university age, college age, your brain is still developing. And so it has been shown that adults who smoked marijuana during adolescence have impaired neural connectivity. So the connections between your neurons in your brain, fewer fibers connecting those neurons than non-smokers. And this connectivity is worse, again, if the younger you started. And this may explain why you can see the frequent use of marijuana in adolescence into adulthood is associated with a decline in IQ over time. Right. So again, you get worried about that. The other thing that people get worried about is that marijuana could be a gateway drug, right? We've heard about this a lot, especially in the 80s with the war on drugs, right?
It's a gateway to conspiracy theories, I'll tell you that much.
Well, we'll get to that. You mean in terms of people acting like paranoid and whatever?
There's that, but then also the people who are generally, you know, dude, trust me, the government is doing this is what's happening. And, you know, and they're right half the time, but the other half is just
the other half, they're high. So the thought is that some drugs like cannabis and alcohol and nicotine can prime the brain for a heightened response to other drugs. That's a theory, right? Another theory is pretty much that people who take drugs are more likely to start with marijuana because it's accessible and now, of course, legal in places like Canada. And then your interaction there with other drug users may increase the probability that you try other drugs. Now, you could argue then, Ali, well, no, wait a minute. If it's legalized now, that may be different, right? Because now you're not interacting in this sort of illegal, illicit society, right? If you guys have visited Canada recently, there is a cannabis shop on every block in every major city in Canada. It's crazy. I don't know how they all stay in business, to be honest with you, but I thought what you were getting at before, Ali, is this relationship to mental illness. Because regular marijuana use is associated with an increased risk of anxiety and depression. Now, you could say, is there a chicken or egg situation? You know, is it because people are anxious or depressed that they use marijuana, you know, versus a causal relationship? But nevertheless, we see this association. And of course, a lot of people, as we said, with anxiety or depression, may be using it to help their symptoms. Now, marijuana has also been linked to psychosis, especially the psychosis associated with schizophrenia, and especially with people with a pre-existing genetic vulnerability. So, you know, I have had patients who, if they have a very strong family history of mental illness, especially schizophrenia, you get very worried about their use of cannabis because it has been associated with a risk of first episode and new onset psychosis in patients, especially if there's a familial predisposition. So I would be very cautious of people with a strong family history of mental illness in terms of using marijuana at all, actually.
These are brain and mental health related issues. Are there other effects on the body in general?
Well, there's a couple. One is that marijuana smoking, when you actually smoke it, so this wouldn't be with someone who ingests marijuana through like gummies or something like that, it can be associated with inflammation of your airways, kind of like a bronchitis. And this is consistent with the fact that regular marijuana smokers, you know, complain of this breathing issues much more than non-smokers. There's a few other very specific ones that affect certain parts of the body. So there's one called this cannabinoid hyperemesis syndrome. Have you heard about this at all?
It sounds scary.
It is, yeah. So this was originally thought to be rare, but now it's being seen very frequently. Some emergency room doctors are saying they see it almost daily. This is probably in Canada due to the more widespread availability of cannabis products. So what will happen is they don't know exactly why this happens, but there are cannabinoid receptors in all parts of the body, including our brain, but also in our gut and our stomach and our esophagus, right? And so it's thought that these receptors become hyperactivated with chronic use of cannabis. So it basically happens with heavy users, so people who smoke 20 or more times a month. I'm assuming, Ali, that describes many of your comedian friends.
Some of them, certainly, yeah. With younger comedians, certainly, yeah, that is.
I'm just teasing. But so it's usually people between the ages of 18 to 40, and they come in with very frequent bouts of nausea, vomiting, and moderate to even severe abdominal cramping. So you're going to think they have some appendicitis, they have some sort of issue like that. So it's very important for doctors when they see them in the emergency room to ask about cannabis use, and especially excessive cannabis use. The patients present with, so come into the emergency room with a combination of vomiting and screaming, which has led some people to call it
scromiting.
You got it, scromiting. I've never heard that term before, but apparently emergency is called that. And they also interestingly report that their symptoms can be relieved temporarily by hot showers for whatever reason. The problem is you try to treat them with typical things that we use for nausea in the emergency room. Like you might have heard of ondansetron, the brand name for that is Zofran in Canada. And it doesn't really work that well. Sometimes they actually have to use what are called antipsychotic medications, even though we're not using it for psychosis and cannabis, but sometimes that helps. And the most difficult thing to convince patients of is that the cannabis is actually the problem. You know, they just, a lot of people refuse to believe that. Because remember, a lot of people will use cannabis for the treatment of nausea and vomiting, for example, associated with chemotherapy, right? So they're like, why would that be the case? And so they are very reluctant to stop using because the treatment is actually abstinence for weeks to months to kind of relieve the symptoms. So, but getting people to do that. So they often come back to the emergency room many times. Then probably the most serious condition that can occur is something that we see in neurology called reversible cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome. So basically, to go through each of those words, reversal means it can come and go away, but it's constriction of blood vessels in your brain. And basically, we don't know why cannabis would do this, but again, we have cannabis receptors or cannabinoid receptors everywhere in our body, including our brain. And so you get a headache, which is called a thunderclap headache. So we call it a thunderclap headache in neurology because it occurs as quickly as well. Actually, I would guess a bolt of lightning, not thunder, but happens as quickly as thunder, okay? And without any warning, and you have the worst headache in your life. So that's why we always ask, do you have a sudden headache, which is the worst headache of your life? That's a thunderclap headache. And sometimes you can get weakness and actually a stroke in various areas. You can get seizures. And it's because you have multiple areas of your brain that the blood vessels have become very constricted. So, you know, one review in 2007 of 62 cases of this cerebral vasoconstriction syndrome showed that 30% of the patients had significant cannabis use. So again, there are other things that can be associated with it. We see it with cocaine. We see it with other drugs as well. But it's something that, at least in neurology, we have to be aware of.
You know, I wanted to also bring up two things. One is the cultural use of marijuana. And I just wanted to share something that I've heard. But before that, I wanted to talk about this, Asif, something that you sort of opened my eyes to a number of years ago. And obviously, I feel for these parents. Some of them have their children going through epileptic seizures, very, very serious, are not content for whatever reason with what, you know, Western medicine, whatever answers they're getting. And you've had these experiences with some of the parents turn to kind of self-medicating and using marijuana to treat seizures. Can you talk a little bit about that and where that goes wrong, where you've seen that go wrong?
Sure thing. And if people want some more info on this, check out one of our issues in our back catalog. It's episode number one, where we talk about cannabis for seizures. But it's been a few years, so let's rediscuss it a bit. I see it all the time. It's really the CBD portion. THC probably has some effect, but it's usually a bit more the CBD portion. And the short story is it probably works as well as trying another anti-seizure medication. It probably works best for patients who have a genetic form of epilepsy, which a lot of people do not. And in fact, there are many studies which show improvement in seizures in terms of the frequency and duration by using cannabis-containing products. So much so that there is a brand name medication now that is marketed by a pharmaceutical company, which is just about to be released in Canada. It has approval in Canada. It's been available in the States for several years. And it's being prescribed. So in other words, very soon I will be prescribing the cannabis product for patients with epilepsy. Do I think it's a miracle cure? Not really. Do I think there's evidence that it works? There is. There's no question that there is, but it probably works best in some patients versus others. To be clear, though, it still needs to be prescribed in Canada by a physician until, you know, whether it's the pharma grade one or you're giving it, you know, through a manufacturer.
Yeah, this is what I wanted to get at too. Why is that?
You can't just give it to your kids or, you know, just take it as an adult. I guess you can buy it and self-medicate yourself. That's fine, I guess. But for kids,
you why is a bad idea for somebody to just go on their own and buy weed from a weed store and...
Well, because the actual issue is you're supposed to use a product that has minimal or little THC and is predominantly CBD. That's the first thing. So are you talking adults, by the way, Ali, not kids?
No, well, what I'm really getting at is this one particular father who decided that he was going to buy weed, and I think maybe it was the oil, and he was going to administer that to his child who had epilepsy. And it worked for a little while, and then it stopped working.
Yeah, I mean, we covered that case in episode one of Doctor versus Comedian.
Asif, if you think I remember what we talked about in... I'm willing to bet our listeners are more like me than they are like
true.
You. You have a photographic memory of every episode.
Just to be clear, the father didn't just go out and get, you know... do this and give it to their child. They talked to a grower in Colorado who made a special batch that was called Charlotte's Web, named after his daughter. And they found that really helped. And of course, there was a documentary in CNN from Sanjay Gupta where they talked about this. Sadly, that little girl passed away several years ago, you know, as a result of her epilepsy. And the syndrome that she had associated with that.
Okay, that's the Sanjay Gupta story. And Charlotte's Web, I remember that well. Are there not Canadian cases that you're aware of that people have done the same thing and it goes bad, wrong?
It's more than it doesn't work, but all my colleagues have seen patients where you prescribe it and it does appear to work. However, unlike the pharmaceutical grade cannabis that we currently get from growers that is given to you by a dispensary, you can't always guarantee the concentration and the ratios of CBD to THC. So there are some patients who you prescribe it and it seems to work. And then when they get their refill after a few months, it doesn't seem to work. Is it because
it's not the same balance?
Maybe, or maybe it just wore off. Who knows? Because that happens with our regular anticonvulsants too. You prescribe a seizure medicine, they have a honeymoon period for like a month or two, and then the seizures come back. So could that be it? I don't know. And so at least having a pharmaceutical grade one, you will know. I mean, it sounds like I'm in the pocket of Big Pharma, but really, you know that you're giving them the same thing every single time. And then you can really assess whether something works or not.
Well, that's what I was getting at, because I don't want to seem like I'm pro pharma here either, but I do remember hearing these stories and you get to realize, oh, this is the value of having it, you know, mandated. Because I was always like, why does it need to be in the government? Why does it need to be in the government's hand? Why are we desperate to pay tax on marijuana? People are like, legalize it. I was like, isn't it better to have it in a gray area? You go meet your buddy in an alleyway, you get a bag, you go off. Like, I thought that was better. I thought we were in a good place. And only when I heard about this medical component where you have something that is, you know, always the same composition, and when that helps medically, I think that gave me a little bit of an appreciation.
And just to be clear, I have also had some patients who they say, well, I'm just going to go buy it and give it to my kid. And I'm like, if you do that, you are breaking the law. It's like giving your kid alcohol. You're not allowed to do that. And so you cannot do that. So I just, again, it's very important for people to be clear, especially if you want to give it to your child, you need to do it through a physician or someone to have this direction. If you're over 18, you can, I guess, do it. But we talked about the issues with self-medicating, right? The people who are addicted are in theory just self-medicating their anxiety or depression. And the other thing I caution people about is they're often like, well, but cannabis is natural, so I'd rather use something natural. But whether it's natural or unnatural is beside the point. The whole section of this podcast today is talking about the adverse effects of cannabis use, which can still occur even if you're using it for, you know, medicinal purposes. So
sugar and salt are natural as well and also have negative effects on our body.
Excellent. Like, what a great quote.
That was all mine, by the way. I did not read that on the internet anywhere. The last thing I wanted to talk about on this subject was something, again, and I something illuminating for me. It's about 5-6 years ago, guest hosting on a show called Tapestry on CBC, and I interviewed a woman named Denisha Pendergrass. And Denisha is the granddaughter of Bob Marley, comes from, you know, this wonderful lineage and a proud Jamaican. And she was telling me about, like, you know, Jamaicans and people from many of these countries come here, and it's like the country is cold. The country is often, you know, cold both in its reception to people from the islands and, you know, seasonally cold. There's whatever systemic racism that exists that doesn't, you know, give them what they had hoped to get. There's all kinds of issues that they face. The food is not the same. You know, it's just tough to get access to all the things you had back home. But the one thing that they have back home, which they can find here, is marijuana. And for them, marijuana, she said, marijuana is not a drug. Marijuana is a plant that grows in the ground. People told you it was a drug for, you know, a variety of reasons to keep you from using something where you could relax, you could naturally relieve your anxiety. And most of all, she said, for us, it's, you know, for Jamaicans, we feel like it's something that we partake in socially, and then we discuss and we deliberate and we talk about things. And she said, and when you come here and you find out that you are going to go to jail for using something that grew in the ground that you were able to do in Jamaica, that whole conversation really opened my eyes, because we're like, you know, falling over each other here in the West. And I'm talking about, you know, white people, but I'm talking about me as well, where it's like we're falling over each other. Be like, oh, this wine is incredible. Oh, this beer, or this brewer is using this type of yeast. And like, as if alcohol is such a fantastic thing and marijuana is such an awful thing. And we cannot forget, as we talk about this, how many people have languished in prison over like tiny amounts of possession of marijuana for their own use, particularly in the U.S., definitely here in Canada. Let's not get it twisted. And so I think it's good to have a little bit of a, you know, to not have a double standard around weed and alcohol. They're both dangerous in many ways. And I've talked about alcohol in the show as well. It's not a elixir from the gods by any means. It's something that's profiting the people who make it. And that's the main important thing to take away from it. And I think with marijuana as well, I think used in certain ways, in certain circles, I don't think you should be, you know, what's the word? I don't think you should be deriding it and looking at it with this suspicious view all the time. It needn't be that. But yeah, I think that was an important thing to mention too, just from that chat I had, like getting a little insight on people who use marijuana socially and casually and don't smoke it chronically and don't have these ill effects as a big part of their life.
That's our episode for today. Let us know what you guys thought. DrVComedian@gmail.com. DrVComedian on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We are everywhere. Yeah, let us know what you guys thought about Dave Chappelle in general. If you guys watched The Dreamer, what you guys thought about that special. And what you guys thought about our discussion about the medical complications of cannabis. What do you got going on for March?
Canada Reads, buddy. Canada Reads is the first week of March. For those who don't know, it is a battle of the books. 5 prominent Canadians debate for 4 days about which book, you know, all of Canada should read. It's at the end of the day, it's a huge celebration of literature, and it's watched by a lot of Canadians. Almost a couple million people will watch it or listen to it, catch it online. And there's a growing number of Americans who will catch it too, particularly ones who are close to their northern border can access it more easily.
Okay, that's great, Ali. But please remember that although I'm a doctor, I'm not your doctor. Medical issues we talk about are for your interest and information only, and they're not medical advice. Please consult your medical professionals for actual medical advice. Thanks for listening.
Bye. Thank you.